Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new reality in the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The takeover of the Palestinian parliament by Hamas will trigger tough action by Israel, the U.S., and the European Union. Unless Hamas renounces violence and recognizes Israel's right to exist, they'll cut off the money that protects the territories from total collapse. On To The Point, will that force Hamas to change its ways? If not, will Palestinian voters force change on their own? Would dealing with Hamas now be appeasing terrorism? Would anything less be punishing voters in a budding democracy? A reporter's notebook later on, can a newly elected leader keep the peace in Haiti? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. When Hamas takes over the newly elected parliament, the Palestinian government stands to lose the money that keeps it afloat. On To The Point, we'll talk about democracy, terrorism, and the tough choices facing Israel, the U.S., the European Union, and Hamas. On Reporter's Notebook, will a political deal stop the violence in Haiti and give a newly elected president a chance to govern? First, this news update. After an 18-month investigation, five envoys of the United Nations say the United States should close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. Suzanne Goldenberg is Washington correspondent for The Guardian of London. Suzanne, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
The envoys did not go to Guantanamo Bay itself. Why not?
Well, basically, the envoys requested permission to visit Guantanamo and to meet with the detainees. The U.S. government gave them permission for three of the detainees to stage a one-day visit to Guantanamo, but it did not give them permission to meet any of the detainees. And in those circumstances, the envoys declined.
So three of the envoys could go, but they couldn't meet the detainees while they were there.
Correct, and it was a one-day visit.
Where, then, did they get their information?
Their information is based on secondhand sources, if you like. They've interviewed former detainees, but they've relied quite heavily on interviews with lawyers for the detainees. In addition, they say that they have had questionnaires that they submitted to U.S. officials.
What conditions do they describe that lead them to the conclusion that Guantanamo Bay ought to be closed?
Well, their recommendation for the closure of Guantanamo is based on the legal framework under which Guantanamo is established rather than the conditions at the prison itself. So they question the legality under which Guantanamo was set up and the legality at which by which the detainees are being held indefinitely. And those are that's the reason why they're calling for it to be closed rather than the conditions in which the detainees are being held.
What are the legal concerns that they have?
Well, basically, it's the application of international human rights law to areas of armed conflict. Now, as some of your listeners may know, the Guantanamo enjoys a very peculiar legal status. It was set up outside the borders of the United States, and therefore the U.S. government maintains that it is not subject to the overview by U.S. courts. That means that detainees there can be held indefinitely and are not granted the right to a trial. So the envoys take issue with that legal framework. They say that it is not valid under international human rights law.
Again, we're talking with Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian in London. What did they say about the conditions?
They focus on a number of issues. I mean, in terms of the areas where they're most critical, that has to do with interrogation techniques, where they say it was never clear what techniques were authorized and which were torture. The envoys also say that force feeding of detainees who have been on a hunger strike since last August has often been excessively violent. They say that the movement of detainees has often been violent and that this constitutes something very close to torture. In addition, they make criticism about the about religious freedom at the prison circumstances for the detainees to sort of practice their faith, which is for most of the, almost all the people there is Islam, and they raise concerns about the health of the detainees, particularly their mental health.
I understand that the Bush administration already has rejected the recommendation that Guantanamo Bay be closed. What authority does the UN have now if it chooses to go further?
Well, there is no the UN has no authority to over Guantanamo, and this report is not binding on anyone. This has a sort of moral authority, if you will. It will add to an atmosphere of criticism of Guantanamo, and it must be said that this comes at a time when there's renewed scrutiny of the United States and its human rights record. There's new pictures out showing abuse at Abu Ghraib, so the whole climate becomes much more difficult for the U.S. with this.
There's also been a lot of criticism of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. The envoys were, as I understand it, attached to that organization. Does that in any way mitigate the power of their findings?
Well, I'm certain that, you know, that argument will be made against them. But if you look at the individual credentials of these envoys, they're very impressive. I'm personally familiar with the envoy from Pakistan who's devoted her life towards fighting for human rights in Pakistan. So I think it's going to be hard to argue against the credentials of the individual envoys.
Okay, so then the report will be issued, and there will be controversy about it. The Bush administration then has the authority, I gather, to either close it down or keep it going, depending on what it decides.
Absolutely, and as we've seen today in the immediate reaction, there is the Bush administration has no intention of closing it down, and indeed it dismissed the recommendations of the UN envoys out of hand.
All right, well, we'll see what kind of reaction we get as the days go by. Meantime, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be there.
Suzanne Goldenberg, again, reporting from Washington for the Guardian newspaper of London. In a moment, a new reality in the Middle East on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. On Saturday, the newly elected Palestinian parliament will be sworn in, with Hamas in the majority for the first time. Hamas will not renounce violence or recognize the right of Israel to exist, so Israel plans to freeze $50 million a month in taxes and customs duties, money that the Palestinian Authority needs to pay 140,000 employees who support a third of the population. The U.S. and Europe regard Hamas as a terrorist organization, which means that a large portion of their aid to the Palestinians will be held up as well. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large of the Daily Star. That's a newspaper, English-language newspaper, in Beirut, distributed throughout the Arab world. And Rami Khoury, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
You have written that the international community's response so far has been hasty and unwise. What do you mean?
Well, I think they shouldn't place conditions before seeing what happens with the new Palestinian government. This is a government of all the Palestinian people, or at least all the people in the occupied West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, but it represents symbolically the Palestinians. And I think we need to give Hamas and the new members in the government, whoever they may be, give them time to see what they suggest. The other problem I have with the American-Israeli positions is they're very one-sided. It's perfectly legitimate to ask Hamas to recognize Israel and not to attack Israelis, but only if the Israelis reciprocate in the same way and don't kill Palestinians and keep expropriating and colonizing their land. So if we're talking about a peace process and a peace negotiation and security and safety and stability and sovereignty, those must be applicable for both sides. If we're only talking about the security of the Israelis as a precondition for getting anywhere, I don't think anybody in the region is going to support that.
Do you think that as a result of the withdrawal of funding from the government, that the pressures of having to govern, having to provide services and all that that implies, and particularly the pay, the salaries of so many government employees, will force Hamas to make a change in its positions?
I kind of doubt it. I really doubt it. If you look at Hamas's position over the last almost 20 years since they've been in existence, one of the things that is striking about them is they've been very principled, very consistent. You may like them, you may not like them, but they really have stuck to principles. They have succeeded in many ways, and that's one of the reasons why they were elected. Now, they got 44% of the vote. A majority of Palestinians didn't vote for them, voted for somebody else. But the way the system works, like George Bush didn't get a majority in his first election, and he became president. So this is how democracies work. So these guys are very principled. They have their positions that they believe have brought them success and now have brought them into the government. And they're not going to just suddenly change because of external pressure. But at the same time, if the government is starved of money, it creates real problems. And I don't know how they will respond to that other than trying to replace that money from other sources, obviously. But it would backfire, I'm pretty sure.
Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star. I'll get back to you, particularly on that issue of backfire, in just a moment. First, we have with us on the line Ghazi Hamad, who's publisher of a weekly newspaper in the Palestinian territories run by Hamas. It's called Al Risala. And Ghazi Hamad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Khoury says he doesn't anticipate that Hamas will change its views, and yet a lot of money is involved here. How can Hamas govern if it doesn't have the money it's getting now from Israel and the Western governments?
Yeah, first of all, we should not believe that money is the most important thing. I think that the first important priority for Hamas now is to solve the problems of the Palestinian people, especially the poverty, unemployment, and also the absence of security and law. We try now to impose a new situation in the Palestinian territory. So I think people, international community, should now give Hamas a chance now to let Hamas to arrange the situation, but don't put precondition now that you have to recognize that. I think first of all, should wait until Hamas for the government. I think Hamas now is ready now to cooperate with the international community and to talk about all issues, including the political situation. But I think this question should be directed to Israel, not to Hamas now, because Hamas is not a terrorist organization. Hamas is fighting for its for the sake of the Palestinian people, for freedom and dignity and prosperity. So we are interested now to continue funding of the European community and Americans for Palestinian people, but we are not ready to sell our political decision for money.
All right. I understand your point about the money. Let me ask you, though, how it will be possible to solve the unemployment problem, as you described it, provide the security, which would include the salaries for the people, of course, that work for the security forces, if you don't have the money that's coming in now. It's my understanding go ahead.
Yes, I think we can collect money. It is not a problem. First of all, we think that the international community, especially United States or European, they will not leave this country because they have political interests. They will not cut all their assistance or cut relationship because they know that other countries, they will be here and they will be more active in the Palestinian territory. Second, we know that we can receive support, funding support, and funding and financial support from the Gulf countries, from Islamic countries, and many countries. From the very week of winning Hamas elections, they said, don't worry about money. We can give you everything. So I think also in the same time, if we change our economy and develop our economy and make our people productive, and I think Hamas now is connected to the some famous investors from the Arabic and Islamic world, and they are ready now to make investments in the Palestinian territory. We can't push the economy forward. So we
Very quickly, if I may, the telephone connection is not very clear. Let me ask you this. Will Hamas ever renounce violence or indicate that it is willing to recognize Israel?
Yeah, the question now is Hamas should not now get everything free without things. First of all, we have to ask Israel if they are ready to give up for the Palestinian territory, if they are ready to withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza, if they are ready that to recognize the right of return. But now we are the victims of the occupation.
Okay.
And we are waiting answer from Israel. And I think Hamas is ready to talk about political compromise. Hamas now is talking about only truth.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, the telephone connection is very bad, very difficult to understand. Ghazi Hamad, the publisher of the Hamas weekly newspaper, Al-Risala. But let me go back to Rami Khoury. It was my understanding that what he was saying was that Hamas is ready to talk, ready to cooperate, but they're not going to give up on those particular principles, as you called them earlier, unless they get something back from Israel. Would that be a satisfactory statement of what he was saying?
I think so. I think Hamas is basically saying that it is willing to talk about issues that are important to Israel and the West and other people. It is willing to do reciprocal gestures, but it is not going to make a unilateral gesture. And if people expect it to, they're going to be disappointed. I think the actions of Hamas in recent years have been quite telling. You know, they did adhere to the one-year truce very, very strictly. Other people were attacking Israel, but Hamas stuck to its truce very clearly. Their campaign for the election focused heavily on the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, and didn't reiterate the issue of not recognizing Israel. So they have made pragmatic gestures, I would call them. They've made pragmatic gestures that indicate how they might keep doing this. Now that they're in power, they are accountable, responsible to all the Palestinian people there, not just the people who voted for them. The pressures of governance are going to be very, very strong on them, especially if aid money is withheld. And I think, you know, incumbency breeds responsibility, which in turn breeds pragmatism and moderation and realism. And I think they will keep being pragmatic.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt you in the interest of time. Again, Rami Khoury, editor at large of the Daily Star. We'll get back to him in a moment. But I want to introduce Barry Rubin. He is director of the Global Research Institute in International Affairs. That's an Israeli think tank. He's editor of the Middle East Review of International Affairs, author of Yasser Arafat, a political biography, and The Long War for Freedom, the Arab Struggle for Democracy in the Middle East. Mr. Rubin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've heard from Rami Khoury the argument for dealing with Hamas. They have won the election. They have made pragmatic gestures, he says. We heard from Mr. Hamad, the Hamas publisher, that they are willing to talk at this time. Why not?
Well, first of all, many of these statements. Well, let me start by saying, I mean, I think Rami said that Hamas should be given a chance, and then he said they wouldn't take the chance. The question is going to be for people who say it should be given a chance, how many months are they going to then, after how many months, are they going to support the pressures and the conclusion that they haven't responded? Now, a lot of what we heard has no relationship whatsoever to reality. It has to either propaganda or wishful thinking. If we actually look at the statements of Hamas, including during the election, they repeatedly reiterated their goal of destroying Israel. They're basically an organization with a genocidal goal. These statements, I can read you off 30 or 40 of them since the election. On their website, they have now put statements saying, we will drink the blood of the Jews. Wherever the Jews go, we will kill them. Their videos call for Israel's destruction over and over and over again. One of their leaders made a speech that Islam will rule the entire world. This is an organization whose basic viewpoint is similar to that of Osama bin Laden. Their priorities of attack might be different. This is the closest thing we have in the contemporary world to the German Nazi Party. And I don't say that lightly. As I say, this can be backed up not only with their original charter, but with statements they're making every day. We have another statement by a Hamas member of parliament talking about how they're going to start kidnapping Israeli soldiers. So this organization has a record. It has a record since January 25th. I don't take seriously its pretensions to peace. And neither do, I think, most other Palestinian political activists, including people in Fatah, who are very unhappy with the situation and are certainly saying things in private to the effect that they favor this kind of pressure. So how can you deal with such a regime? Hamas leaders have also said that they're going to ensure that the Palestinian educational system teaches systematically anti-Semitism and support for terrorism. So this, if there's any organization that's extreme, it's this one. In addition to that, although we don't have time to go into it, but if we would have a long discussion about history, there's not such a history of radical groups becoming moderate and when they get into government. We have a 12-year experience with Mr. Arafat and with the Fatah movement, and I would argue, although that goes beyond the bounds of this, but I'll just say in one sentence, that the responsibilities of government did not make them pragmatic.
Okay.
So this, basically, what should be understood is all of the things Hamas is saying, leaders of Hamas, official videos, official statements, which are quite extreme. The very small number of statements that can be branded moderate are almost without exception made in English to Western reporters for propaganda purposes. This is not what they're telling each other, and this is not what they're telling their own people.
All right. Barry Rubin again with the Center for Global Research and International Affairs in Israel. Rami Kouri, back to you with the Daily Star in Beirut. Why should the Israelis, why should anybody else deal with Hamas if, in fact, all the things Barry Rubin just said are true?
Well, I mean, Barry Rubin has the right to say what he wants. He can live in any kind of dark world he wants to. He can analyze things the way he wants. I mean, I found his analysis, while some of the things he said are factually correct, the totality of it is slightly hysterical, I think, and looking backwards rather than forwards. I'm not saying Hamas is a wonderful group of people. What I'm saying is they're legitimately elected government. They will now head a legitimately elected government. They understand the need for pragmatism when you talk to them. When you read their materials, when you engage them, they understand that their policy, their charter of 1987, is not one that is adhered to by the majority of Palestinian people to whom they are now accountable. They know they have to make an accommodation with the State of Israel. My understanding of them, talking to them, reading their stuff, listening to them, and just watching them behave politically, which I think is the best indicator. I mean, what they do rather than what they say, I think, is the most significant thing. And my suspicion is that they will continue to be more pragmatic, meaning they will come to terms with the State of Israel. Now, they will not do that unilaterally, though. Right now, they are fighting a resistance war. They're fighting the occupation. They're fighting Israeli settlements and expansion and the murder of Palestinians. So they are in a resistance mode, which is why partly they won. Now, we can keep fighting this war if we want, or we can find a middle ground where the rights of the State of Israel and the rights of the Palestinians to nationhood can exist, and that's where I think we should head.
Rami Kouri, leaving us now, editor-at-large of the Daily Star. We'll be back with Barry Rubin and others in a moment. On Reporter's Notebook a little later, can a newly elected leader keep the peace in Haiti? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Once again, the parliament, newly elected parliament in the Palestinian territories will be sworn in on Saturday. Israel has said it will immediately freeze $50 million a month in taxes and customs duties, that money that the Palestinian Authority needs to pay something like 140,000 employees, said to support a third of the population. The United States and the European Union, who regard Hamas as a terrorist organization, are now threatening to do the same thing, withhold the money that they provide. We just heard from Rami Kouri at the Daily Star in Beirut saying that this is now the legitimately elected government of the Palestinian territories. They have to be accountable to their people. They're going to have the pressures of governance. dependence on them and that it's incumbent upon other governments to deal with them. Again, back to Barry Rubin at the Center on Global Research and International Affairs.
I just want to say, like, Rami, basically what Rami said is ignore all the evidence. And may I also say that people who are extremists and terrorists sometimes actually don't tell the truth, we might imagine. But we are looking at the body of material. These are people who believe, as Rami said, in an ideology, and their ideology is a profoundly anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, extremist ideology, which they're not going to lightly change. The second point is that, unfortunately, these are the people who are preventing a resolution of the conflict. Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip. Israel has stated that it accepts the creation of an independent Palestinian state. The fact that these people are claiming everything, are demanding Israel's destruction, are carrying out terrorist operations, this is what is preventing progress from being made diplomatically. So they pose as the victims of a conflict which they are the ones who are sustaining. But let's examine the evidence. Finally, remember what we're talking about here. The question is, should the United States, should Europe, and should Israel give aid, actually pay money to support a regime that takes those positions and is involved in terrorism? There are actually laws in the American legal system which says that the U.S. cannot give aid or assistance to regimes that are sponsoring terrorism. So it's a question, do you actually want to support these people and then let them turn to their people and say, well, you see, we have our positions and we don't have to change them because, in fact, we're doing just fine and we're getting, you know, $1.5 billion a year in foreign aid, despite not changing our position.
All right. Barry Rubin, again, the Center for Global Research and International Affairs in Israel, political biographer of Yasser Arafat. Fawaz Jurjis is professor and chair of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. His most recent book is The Jihadists, Unholy Warriors. Professor, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What if, in fact, the United States and Israel do, as Barry Rubin says, and as the governments of the United States and Israel and the European Union as well, although it appears to be somewhat divided, is also saying, what if they do that? What do you think the result will be?
Well, I think starving the Palestinians out of financial resources is a highly risky and dangerous strategy. I mean, I think we all agree on that, aside from the moral questions involved. And I think in the last 48 hours or so, Hamas leaders are saying, well, listen, we have Israel and the United States to blame. I think talking to Palestinians and observing Palestinian civil society very closely, I would argue that starving the Palestinians out of much-needed funds would likely drive more Palestinians into Hamas arms instead of basically alienating the Palestinian electorate and turning the Palestinians against Hamas, if this is really the current thinking of the Bush administration and the Israeli government.
How much hardship would be caused if the money were withheld?
Well, Warren, let's put it this way. I think about 60% or probably 70% of the Israeli budget comes from foreign aid.
You mean the Palestinian budget?
Yes, $1.9 billion. About more than $1 billion comes from the European Union, from the United States, from taxes given by Israel and other Arab funds. This is a very serious situation. And remember, too, that you have almost in Gaza, 40% of Palestinians live below the poverty line. Unemployment is over 30%. Not just the salaries of Palestinian security forces. This would really create a major social upheaval. And the question on the table, starving the Palestinian population, punishing the Palestinian population, is this really the, correct way to proceed? And should we punish the Palestinian people for basically speaking out their minds and electing Hamas, regardless of what you think of Hamas? I think there are many questions involved, and even on utilitarian political questions, I would question the efficacy of this particular strategy, not just on moral grounds, but also on strategic and political grounds as well.
Professor Fawaz Georges at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. Danielle Pletka is Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, conservative organization. She was formerly on the staff of the Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs. Ms. Pletka, good to have you back on our show.
Nice.
Respond, if you will, to what we heard from Fawaz Georges, the moral consequences of withholding the money, the possibility that it would drive more Palestinians to Hamas, and that it is really punishment for what the Bush administration has been doing, spreading democracy in the Middle East.
There aren't any nice, glib answers to this problem. It is the honest-to-goodness truth. But U.S. foreign assistance is not an entitlement program. It's not an entitlement program for impoverished people. There are plenty of people in need around the world to whom we do not give money. So the idea that somehow by taking it away because suddenly a terrorist group has become part of the political leadership of an area is not unconscionable. We have not, for many, many years, given money to the Palestinian Authority. U.S. law precludes assistance to the PLO. Giving money directly to the PA was a very bad idea for a huge variety of reasons, most of which caused the Palestinian people to decide not to vote for them. In other words, it was that they were misspending, they were corrupt, they were bad, and they weren't using it for their own people. So USAID hasn't gone directly to the Palestinian Authority in many years, not since 1993. But should we continue to provide or subsidize the governance of Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza through NGOs and other organizations? You know, instinctively, you want to say that the taxpayer of the United States should not be facilitating Hamas rule. And while, again, it is very difficult, and there will be unintended victims, at the same time, we do have to set moral guidelines for the kind of money that we give out. Subsidizing terrorism, even indirectly, is wrong.
What about the Secretary of State, who, as I understand it, said yesterday, testifying before Congress, that humanitarian aid will continue?
Humanitarian aid goes all over the world, and I don't think that's ever at question. I don't think any of the people who are chatting here today have even brought into question the idea of health or food. We gave money to Iran after the earthquake there several years ago. This is something that happens as a matter of course, no matter how bad a guy there is in charge in any country. So humanitarian aid isn't in question. But there are a whole series of other things that the United States has done over the years to try and help with governance in the PA, to try and help set up better institutions and better systems that don't have to do with food in the mouths of Palestinian women and children. And those things are going to stop.
What about the issue of American policy of spreading democracy in the Middle East? Here is the first example of a Middle Eastern people who have, in fact, elected their government. Our earlier guest, Rami Khoury, has said they're the only legitimate government in the Middle East in that regard. Is the U.S. being inconsistent in that context?
I don't think the U.S. is being inconsistent. I didn't hear Rami say that, but of course that's
no, he has
true.
Written that, and he didn't say it on this program.
No. But in fact, Iraq has an elected government. Israel has an elected government. And the Palestinians did have these elections. There are a couple of important points before I answer your question directly. The first is that democracy isn't just elections. Within the Palestinian Authority, although there were a large number of political parties running, the bottom line is that the tools of government and media were in the hands of Fatah and its cronies, and the tools of Islam and the mosque and charitable organizations were in the hands of Hamas and Islamic extremist organizations. All of the good and decent Palestinian political players, who many of us know, were largely shut out of the process. There aren't the kind of democratic institutions that provide good choices to people, and that's a growing process. You do have a debate as an outside country advocating democracy. You're not going to go from an authoritarian government to a Jeffersonian democracy in one step. How are you going to manage the interim steps? That's where we are right now, and the bottom line is the Palestinian people have made their choice. You can call it an imperfect democratic choice. You can call it, not based on good building blocks, but at the end of the day, they made their choice. And it seems to me that the pressure needs to be put on the people they elected to make decisions that won't hurt their constituency. In other words, to recognize Israel's right to exist and renounce violence and terrorism. That's what ought to happen, because at the end of the day, it will be Hamas that is victimizing the Palestinian people, not all those outsiders who are saying, hey, play by the rules of the international community.
Danielle Pletka, once again at the American Enterprise Institute. Fawaz Georges, back to you at Sarah Lawrence College. What do you say to what we've heard, that the USAID isn't an entitlement program in the first place, and that Hamas is responsible, not the U.S.?
By the way, American aid is not really pivotal. And the speaker suggested, we just really started giving money to the Palestinians. And by the way, this is not charity. We give aid because, as you know, our vital interests are involved. We don't give aid because we are really good-hearted. We give aid because somehow we think that giving aid serves American interests. This is a fundamental principle of international relations and has been so in American foreign policy. The second question, and this is really the larger point I want to make today, that this is, Warren, the beginning of the process, not the end of the process. Initially, Arab and Muslim voters are basically voting for Islamists in Egypt, in Iraq, in Morocco, in Lebanon, and now in Palestine, because the existing political forces, such as, you know, President Mubarak or Fatah, basically are seen as corrupt and inept. They're trusting the Islamists to deliver the goods, both the social goods and a peace in the case of the Palestinians. And the question here, the question we're trying to answer is that what's the most effective strategy to proceed? Does starving the Palestinians not only serve American and Israeli foreign policy, but in fact would alienate the Palestinian electorate from Hamas? My question is that, in fact, it would produce the opposite results from the intended consequences. It would drive more Palestinians into Hamas arms. It would alienate Arab and Muslim citizens from American foreign policy further. There is a widespread perception that America is not genuine about the democratic process. Let the Palestinians have a look at how Hamas govern. Does Hamas have a magical wand to overcome Palestinian problems? I don't believe so. Give Hamas a chance. Hamas has evolved, is evolving. It has a long way to evolve. Let's exert pressure on Hamas. Let's nudge Hamas to basically, let's see whether Hamas can basically become a partner in the peace process. Well, look, if Ariel Sharon can somehow be transformed from, a major, you might say, voice against the peace process into a man of peace, might be Hamas. Could it be somehow that Hamas could also evolve? The question is, starving the Palestinians out of funds is a highly risky, a highly reckless strategy, and I would argue this is the wrong way to move forward.
Fawaz Georges again, professor at Sarah Lawrence College. Back to Barry Rubin at the Center for Global Research and International Affairs.
I think that this thing has been misstated. Nobody is going to starve. The question is the U.S., and remember that much of the money that's been raised internationally has been at through U.S. efforts.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you this. I heard Dennis Ross, the former envoy of the United States to the peace process, saying today that 80% of the economy in the Palestinian territories depends on Israel. How are they not going to starve, then, if 80% of the economy is effectively withdrawn?
Because people grow food, and in fact, they it's an agricultural area. But at any rate, the point, and humanitarian aid will go through, and money will be given to NGOs and so on. So this vision of starving is not going to happen.
But what about, do you want to see a collapsed state next door?
Well, you have a collapsed state next door. You have, the implication here is, if you only help Hamas, it's going to establish this stable regime and so on. You have a state of anarchy. The problem is not economic. The problem is political. You have warlords. You think the Fatah people are going to give up their guns and let Hamas take over the security services. And by the way, doesn't Hamas want to throw them out of jobs and put in its own people? And so you can't just reduce this. The question is the U.S. and other countries going to subsidize an anti-Semitic terrorist, or anti-Christian, anti-Semitic terrorist organization? And again, read what they are saying in Arabic. Read what they say on their website. Read what they say every day. I don't believe these people believe their ideology.
Professor Georges, what about that? Were you suggesting, I don't think you're any supporter of Hamas, were you suggesting that by giving Hamas a chance, it would be giving them enough rope to hang themselves? Do you think they'd be unsuccessful?
You know, Warren, no one is suggesting let's give money to Hamas. The United States, neither the United States nor the European Union will give money to Hamas. That's not the question. What I'm suggesting is that invest in Palestinian civil society. Invest in Palestinian institutions, in the social structure. And just very sad, he said, well, look, we already have a failed, collapsed state. I mean, Barry, did you think for a minute that the reasons why the Palestinians voted Hamas, not only because Fatah and the Palestinian Authority was corrupt and inept, but because the peace process did not go anywhere? Did we think for a minute that in the eyes of the Palestinians, many Palestinians believe that both Israel and the United States let Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, down? So in many ways, we cannot just have the cakes and eat it too. I mean, we have to think why the Palestinians voted Hamas in, because in the eyes of many Palestinians, they don't believe that somehow the peace process is going anywhere. Fatah is highly corrupt and inept. And the question here is, give the Palestinians a chance to see how Hamas governs. Hamas does not have a magical wand. And I would argue, in almost every single Arab and Muslim state, the second round of elections, basically Hamas will likely do much worse than it basically did a few weeks ago, because at the end of the day, Hamas cannot deliver the social goods, cannot deliver the peace to Israel unless it engages the international community, unless it engages Israel. And in this particular sense, we just should not look at what Hamas says. Of course, I agree. I mean, Barry is absolutely correct. We should, I mean, listen to what Hamas says. But at the same time, let's see what Hamas does in the next few weeks and next few months ahead.
Barry Rubin, we've only got about a minute left for you to respond to that, if you would.
I have great respect for Professor Georges. I would say this. Number one, if you give them $1.5 billion a year, they're going to do a lot better and perform better and persuade the Palestinian voters that they're doing a good job. Secondly of all, remember that the U.S. has helped deliver $4 billion in aid to Palestinian Authority. They don't know, people don't know about that because Fatah and Hamas media don't tell them. They teach them to hate America. And so, you know, no matter how much money U.S. and others give, they're not going to get credit for it. The reason there's no peace is because of Fatah and Hamas have blocked it. So if you want to subsidize this regime, then of course it's more likely to be successful. We'll see when the next election is. And we've seen in other countries that failed regimes still retain power and support to the ideology. So let me say, if people say, give them a couple months, let's see a couple months, but let's not look at what they say in their interviews to Western reporters. Let's see what they say to their own people and what they do with their institution. This is an extremely radical regime, and believe me, the Fatah people and the other people in the Palestinian opposition are privately talking in favor of pressure, because they believe this is how they're going to fail and they're going to get rid of this regime.
Thank you all for being with us. We, of course, will be following this with great interest. And once again, the new parliament will be sworn in on Saturday. We'll see what happens next. Barry Rubin at the Center for Global Research and International Affairs. If I was Georges, professor at Sarah Lawrence College, thanks to both of you. Thanks earlier to Danielle Pletka, to Danielle Pletka, the American Enterprise Institute, and Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star. Thanks, too, to Ghazi Hamad, the publisher of the Hamas Weekly newspaper, Al Risala, for joining us a bit earlier. After 4 days of angry street demonstrations, René Préval has been declared the new president of Haiti with just 51% of the vote. A deal has been reached over accusations of fraud, and there will not be a runoff election. So what are the prospects for peace and political stability? We'll get some answers on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. During René Préval's first term as president, Haiti was relatively peaceful. Elected in 1996, he became in 2001 the only leader in Haitian history to peacefully turn over power at the end of his term. Now he has another chance in what Reuters The News Service calls a country with a history of dictatorship, violence, and perpetual political chaos. Kathy Klarich has covered Haiti for 20 years. She most recently has been there for Time magazine. She's author of a memoir, Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. Kathy Klarich, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much, Warren.
You were in Haiti last week during the election. What do you think is the source of Mr. Préval's power this time around?
Well, I think he is in answering this in sort of the negatives. His popularity is in large part based on the fact that he didn't alienate any individual sector in Haitian society. During his term, he did not alienate the security forces, the former military, the police, the bourgeois, the business sector, and he continued to maintain support with the base of the Lavalas Party, which was his predecessor and then his successor, President Aristide. And much of his support now comes from that same base, and they came out in massive numbers to vote for him last week.
What about the election itself? There were, ballots found in a dump. There were accusations of fraud. Now, by virtue of what sounds like an agreement of convenience, it's been decided he got 51% of the vote.
Well, I think the election needs to be divided up into two parts. There was the actual voting process, which, although started out incredibly chaotic and unorganized, by the end of the day, lines had formed correctly, and people really did. I think just about everybody who wanted to was able to vote. Obviously, there were some exceptions. What happened after that, however, is a bit of a mystery. There were thousands, tens of thousands, probably, of ballots that were found in the dump right outside Port-au-Prince. Now, how they got there is a big question. There were a number of steps that needed to be taken to get the actual ballots from the polling places to the security of the United Nations, who were responsible for watching the electoral material, but it had to get delivered to them. And I think there were definitely people interested in skewing the vote and throughout these boxes.
Well, you mentioned before that when Préval was president, and I gather during this campaign, he didn't alienate any of the various sectors you mentioned, which was an extraordinary achievement, it would appear, given the history of Haiti. Are there going to be sectors now who resent the fact that there won't be a runoff?
Yes, for sure. But I think given his overwhelming support and that it's going to be hard to dispute, the way that they came to this negotiated settlement, in order to avoid a second a runoff, the candidate needed to have won 50% plus one vote. Préval was just under 49% with about 92% of the votes counted. But there was a large percentage of blank ballots which were included in the total tally that brought his numbers down. So the Electoral Council and Préval's party came up with this agreement that said they would not include the blank ballots in the entire vote. So proportionately, they removed those from the various percentages, which then lifted Préval up over the 50% mark.
What's the difference between Préval and Aristide, who is now in South Africa, as I understand it, and is Préval likely to be able to put together some kind of stable regime?
I think there's quite a difference, and I think that Préval is making a great effort to underscore those differences. He did not run with the same political party as Aristide. He created his own. And he came out 2 days ago, Warren, in a very presidential and statesman-like manner by telling all of the demonstrators that they had the right to be there, but that businesses should be able to open, traffic should be able to flow, schools should stay open, and that people needed to remain calm and respectful. And when he asked them to go home, they did. Now, Aristide has really been criticized for not having that kind of a relationship with the population, which did a lot of damage to property when they were out in great numbers.
What about aid from the international community? Certainly Haiti depends on it. Will Mr. Preval, do you think, be able to get that, and will that help him to provide the kinds of services and I suppose security forces as well to maintain stability?
Yeah, the United Nations mission, which is in Haiti and has been there for 2 years, just renewed their contract for another 6 months. My guess is that the Preval government will negotiate with them, but on their own terms, what kind of support they want from the UN. I know after having talked to some of their campaign people that they're very interested in massive amounts of financial aid coming in. Now, whether or not they're going to get it remains to be seen. The United States, Canada, France, Brazil, they've all said that they will support a legitimately elected government, and now they have to make good on that.
If they don't, and if Mr. Preval can't make some pretty obvious changes relatively quickly, is he in a vulnerable position?
Absolutely. I mean, there are more guns and weapons in Haiti than there have ever been, some 200,000. Various sectors have them and would use them, I think, if they didn't feel that things were going along the way that they wanted them to.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to have you back on our program.
Thanks very much.
Kathy Klarich, again, covered Haiti for 20 years. Her book, Madame Dread, A Tale of Love, Voodoo, and Civil Strife in Haiti. That is a memoir of the 10 years during which she lived there. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Jonah King, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.